Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
Speaking today with Dr. John Fia, author, teacher, and speaker. Dr. Fia is the Distinguished Professor of American History at Messiah University in Pennsylvania, where he's taught since 2002. He runs a blog called The Way of Improvement Leads Home. He's written numerous books and articles for academic journals, but perhaps most importantly for the purposes of this discussion are two of his books I'd like to focus on. His 2011 book, Was America Founded as a Christian Nation? A Historical Introduction, and his most recent 2018 work, Believe Me, The Evangelical Road to Donald Trump. So welcome, Dr. Fia, to Mindshift Podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We were just saying before we hit record that we've got a lot of mutual friends in all the stuff I've been covering on dominion theology, Christian Reconstructionism, the Christian right. So this is kind of in your wheelhouse, isn't it?
It is. And I was telling you again, before we started this conversation, you know, if you would have told me like 10 years ago, 5-10 years ago, that, you know, the sort of Rushdunian Reconstructionism, Seven Mountains Dominionism and so forth was driving the GOP or the Christian right, I would have been slightly skeptical, you know, that it was a major theme. But you know, over the last 4 or 5 years, I have been fully convinced that people like, you know, some of your previous guests, like Julie Ingersoll or Peter Montgomery, or is it McIver?
Yeah, Michael McVicker.
McVicker.
Yeah, you know, he wrote a great book on Rushdoony.
Yeah, have really put their finger on some things that you're really seeing being manifested here in the age of Trump.
So what changed, though? Because obviously you're a historian, so you have done a lot of work on the founding of America as supposedly a Christian nation and all that, which I'm sure we'll get into. But as we know, this, in terms of the Christian right, this has been a long, long project. Yeah. So it didn't just suddenly pop up 4 years ago when Trump came on the scene. Yeah. What changed for you in terms of, you say you became a believer, that was the lights came on?
Yeah. You know, I think this idea that the United States was a Christian nation or somehow founded as a Christian nation has been around since the founding.
Sure.
You know, this was a major theme in the 19th century, but you rarely saw the kind of dominionism or the idea that Old Testament law should be applied to, you know, our republic, the things that came out of the theology of people like Rushdoony, Gary North, the Reconstructionists. You know, Gary DeMar is another figure here who's lesser known. You know, they were kind of fringe groups in the, you know, in the 70s. I think it was really, you know, Francis Schaeffer, this evangelical thinker, wrote a book called How Shall We Then Live, that really brought the ideas of Rushdoony, or translated the ideas of these Christian Reconstructionists into the larger even mainstream evangelical world, especially among conservative evangelicals who would make up the Christian right, or the religious right, or the, you know, it was the earliest manifestation of that, of course, was the Moral Majority in the 1980s. So, you know, as I think it only made sense that these ideas, which had been around for a while, began to get a little more traction in the 1980s when white conservative evangelicals began to put their hopes for, whatever you want to call it, changing the world or advancing the kingdom of God,
dominion,
into politics, right?
Yeah.
You know, so like I said, when all of that took place, you know, as a historian, you know, I had known that, you know, there was a sense of Christian nationalism. Well, we didn't really use that term, like, when I got started with this. You know, that's been a term that's really emerged with force in the last like 5 years, Christian nationalism, you know, to describe the idea that America was founded as a Christian nation. So when I wrote my book, Was America Founded as a Christian Nation, in 2011, you know, Christian nationalism was not even a term that was often used. I don't talk a great deal about Rushdoony, except in my chapter chapter on Schaefer, and I talked about it similar in the way I just did a few minutes ago. Mm-hmm. So I was skeptical that this kind of reconstructionism was driving the project, right? And so you said, what changed my mind? You know, what changed my mind, when I say changed my mind, I mean it was more, I began to give more credence to this. I began to see this more at work as mm-hmm. especially the Trump administration and the evangelical support for the Trump administration kind of revealed a lot of this. You know, you have people like, you know, David Barton, for example, talking about the seven mountains of cultural influence. I think Ted Cruz, I wrote about this during the 2015 campaign, even before Trump was nominated. You know, Ted Cruz seemed to be engaging in, you know, in a kind of dominionism. He would often talk about reclaiming the different parts of culture. I wrote a piece in Christianity Today about Ted Cruz and how I saw this as dominionism. And I couldn't believe the kind of pushback that I was getting, you know, from people like me 10 years ago, right? You know, no, this is not there, you know, and I was arguing like, no, I would have said the same thing, but I don't know what else to call this kind of reclaiming of the culture and all the different mountains of influence, whether it be entertainment, business, education, right? I mean, that seems to be what's at work here. And then, you know, I wrote a piece about Cruz in the Washington Post, which I think got the attention of people like Fred Clarkson. Is that his name? Fred Clarkson mm-hmm. and Peter Montgomery and other Julie Ingersoll and the sort of reconstructionist watchers. And I think it was Fred Clarkson who wrote a piece that said, you know, my suggestion that Cruz was engaging in some kind of reconstructionist theology here, Seven Mountains Dominionism theology here, was a sort of opening to like mainstream evangelicals finally saying like, mm-hmm. oh my gosh, you know, yeah. here it is, you know. So this I think that's the history, I think, behind it. And, you know, by no means was I sort of a catalyst for this, but that's my own personal journey about mm-hmm. how I came to see some of this stuff at work.
I think you're right, because I just spoke with Frank Schaefer the other day for a bonus episode. And, of course, we talked about Rush Dooney. It turns out Frank actually knew Rush Dooney personally. He met him, stayed at his house. I think what you said is basically correct, that Francis Schaefer rejected some of Rush Dooney's more extreme positions, you know, stoning gays and incorrigible teens and trying to establish a theocracy or a theonomy, I guess you could say, the Old Testament law. But yet, I think you're right. He popularized some aspects of this Reconstructionist vision without himself being a Reconstructionist. Yep. That was sort of my take on it.
Well, I don't know what Frank would say about this, but, you know, he's an insider. So, and he's a very mm-hmm. thoughtful insider, right? But I would argue that Francis Schaefer and other historians have argued this, especially Barry Hankins, whose wonderful book biography of Francis Schaefer, if you're interested in this subject, you should read it. But Francis Schaefer, Frank's father, we called him Frankie back then. You know, he was he suddenly become
Frankie
more
Schaefer.
You know, Frankie Schaefer, right? I think Francis is the linchpin to all of this, because he gave people like Jerry Falwell and the sort of pastors, the kind of somewhat anti-intellectual pastors who were, you know, wanting to sort of fight a culture war. He gave them, you know, whatever you think about it, he gave them some kind of intellectual credibility, right? And Francis Schaefer, I think, you know, most historians would say, you know, there are people like leading evangelical scholars today, like George Marsden, for example, the historian, who would point to Francis Schaefer in the late 60s, you know, and the God who is there and some of his deeply philosophical mm-hmm. works. I mean, Francis Schaefer received awards in the 60s from environmental groups for his advocacy of, you know, fighting, you know, we today call climate change and stuff. But I think it was his exposure to Rush Dooney that really turned Francis Schaefer in a different direction. And then if you read like many of the people like Marsden and others associated with the Reformed evangelical tradition, especially the Reformed evangelical tradition coming out of places like Western Michigan, like the Kuyperians, the Calvinists, right? They take if you read their, they had this like intellectual rag called the Reformed Journal, which was wonderful. Mm-hmm. You read the Reformed Journal, you get people like Marsden and Ron Wells and Mark Knoll from Wheaton. And these people just say, oh my gosh, what happened to Francis Schaefer? You know, know, he starts embracing some really suspect historiography about the Renaissance and about the American founding that appears in his book on civil disobedience that he writes, called A Christian Manifesto. And I think it's him embracing Rushduni that causes this turn in his own personal intellectual thinking, which then, of course, leads to him seeing that Falwell and others could provide him with a political platform to make those new ideas a reality. So there's really two Francis Schaeffers, in my opinion. Those people who were going out to Le Brie in the 1960s were kind of being, these were evangelicals who were being exposed to Christian thinking for the first time, that that intellectual life could be a legitimate vocation, right? And I, you know, I was too young, but you know, they talk about the kind of vibrant intellectual community that Schaeffer had at this chalet that he operated out in Switzerland, Le Brie. But I think he's the important key here to the whole story. Yeah.
That's fascinating.
I think Frank would probably agree. I think Frank would agree with that assessment. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's basically the correct view of it, is that he may have picked up from Rushduni this idea that America was founded as a Christian nation and certain historiography, as you say. Yeah. And then the whole piece, as they were pushing the anti-abortion platform with their film series, Whatever Happened to the Human Race, and this is what a lot of the stuff Frank and I talked about, where it relates to the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett, because this is the logical outcome of decades now of dominionist, reconstructionist thinking, to work so hard to put a person like her on the Supreme Court with the specific aim to overturn Roe versus Wade. And that is the political, one of the big political agendas that the Christian right has been working on for decades. Yeah. Where did that come from? This is the piece right here, isn't it?
Yeah, I think to an extent, I think you're right. The idea of overturning Roe versus Wade, though, is a deeply flawed approach if you care about ending and reducing abortions, right? But it is the approach that much of the Christian right adopted from a Rushdunian informed Schaeffer, right? You know, and Schaeffer saw this as, you know, it's all about kind of power. It's all about gaining control of the levers of power so you can bring about a kind of sense of Christian. I mean, it's often sometimes really hard to separate the language of abortion is a moral wrong because science now tells us that a fetus is indeed alive at a certain point, and it's immoral to do that, right? That's one argument, but it's sometimes hard to separate that argument, which I think could be a legitimate argument, and it's actually one that I embrace, from an argument that in order to reduce abortions, we are claiming, it is a way to reclaim America as a Christian nation again, right? I don't think two arguments are the same. Right. You could believe that America is in no way a Christian nation. You could uphold separation of church and state. Right. You could embrace Hugo Black in 1947. Right. There's a wall. It's high and impregnable. Right. And still believe it is immoral to abort a baby. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, so to me, the issue is not necessarily, you know, I don't think those two can be conflated, but in the minds of the Christian right, sometimes it's hard to tell whether they're like making a kind of moral decision or just simply this is part of their dominionist strategy to reclaim the country. Right. Where I would come down on that. That's where I might disagree with, you know, maybe someone who is a pro-choice person who is criticizing this Rushdunian strain within evangelicalism. Right. So, I mean, I think it's a flawed strategy, the Roe v. Wade strategy. Simply, you know, we could get into a whole conversation about this because, you know, overturning Roe v. Wade, if you really care about reducing the number of abortions, will do nothing to, very little, I should say, to reduce the number of abortions, right? Instead, this kind of Rushdunian Christian right culture war kind of mantra of overturning Roe versus Wade has just become a way to raise money for politicians. It's a way for politicians to, I mean, we're seeing this with Trump, right? It's a way in which to hold power, to have a base, a political base, right? All you have to do is just check that box. And I'm convinced that a lot of, not all, but a lot of the candidates that Christian right leaders support could really care less about, you know, unborn babies in the womb.
I think you're absolutely right. I was reading one of your pieces earlier today on the Sojourners. I think you wrote it maybe a year or so ago. And you said that exactly that, that the strategy of the Christian right has been for a long time to, like I say, it's about winning elections, get the right person in the White House who will then appoint Supreme Court justices who are conservative, who will then overturn Roe versus Wade, and we win. And then you said, but they're not thinking about what's the next, what happens after that.
I mean, that's a great point, right? What do you do when you win? Like, what does that mean to then? Win, right? You know, what does that mean? You stick, you know, abortion doctors in prison. You stick women who have abortions in prison. You know, you tell Muslims that, you know, you're second-class citizens, right? I mean, what does it mean to win? Yeah. And I think
what's the end game?
Yeah, and I think that's the ultimate problem with the Christian right. Like, what happens when the dog catches the bumper? You know what I mean? You know, then what happens, right?
It was all about chasing the car.
Yeah. All they want to do is chase the car, right?
Actually catch it.
Yeah, there's no progress. There's no understanding of, like, you know, and this is what I think this whole abortion debate in this election is about, right? You know, I see, you know, they're not all Christian right. They're actually thoughtful, some even Catholic intellectuals, right? People like Robert George at Princeton, a man who I deeply, deeply respect, right? Who goes on the National Review and makes a compelling, logical argument that if you believe that abortion is the killing of a baby, then you cannot in good conscience support a candidate who is like Joe Biden, who is part of the Democratic Party. Okay. Mm-hmm. I disagree with that for various reasons, but it's a legitimate intellectual argument. What bothers me is that then you have people who embrace that argument telling people who will support Joe Biden that they're not true Christians because they're supporting Joe Biden, you know. But the problem with this argument, and there's a guy at a Southern Baptist ethicist who's claiming this, a guy who's been trained in Southern Baptist schools who claims this. I can't, Walker, his last name is. You know, I think the failure is just, once again, right? How long are you going to make a principled stand, right? And what is this principled stand going to do to reduce the number of abortions in America? I'm convinced that poverty relief, dealing with systemic racism, health care for women, right? These are the ways in which the abortion rate is going to continue to drop, which it's been dropping consistently since Clinton, right? So how do these principled stands get us anywhere? And is there a chance that by taking such a moral and principled stand that actually you're allowing, like, more babies will be killed as a result, right? Mm-hmm. I tend to be kind of a Christian realist on this. You know, I tend to, you know, think that Reinhold Niebuhr or Dietrich Bonhoeffer, some of these people actually have a much better understanding of the ethics of all of this than the black and white kind of fundamentalist Christian right. But again, I'm getting off track here on abortion, but, you know, I think it's all tied into it, right? Because I think Rushdunian, Schaefferite kind of idea is that politics is just about, you know, creating a Christian nation, and part of the Christian nation is a Christian nation would not kill babies, right?
Right. Well, and I think going back to your point about Christian nationalism, okay, that's one thing I haven't heard in connection with the Amy Coney Barrett thing. And my view on it is the whole Christian nationalism narrative or myth, whatever you want to call it, is driving a lot of it, because that's the argument, isn't it? Okay, they'll say, well, we're going to win when we overturn Roe versus Wade, and God's going to start blessing America again because we're returning back to the covenant status. We have erred. We've lost our way. We were founded as a Christian nation. We've strayed from that path. We're going to get back to it. And then God will start blessing us. Then all these wonderful things will start happening. So to what extent does Christian nationalism factor into this whole discussion?
Yeah, it's the second Chronicles 7:14 argument, right? I'm not going to quote it, right? But if my people will humble themselves and pray, I will hear their prayers and heal their land, right? Mm-hmm. It always struck me how Mike Pence during the coronavirus, I wrote a little bit about this, Mike Pence during the coronavirus hearings would always end by saying, and we're going to try to talk with Dr. Fauci and help our healthcare workers and we will heal this land, right? I mean, that was such a dog whistle to evangelicals, you know, who knew
allusion to
no one else got it. Right. You know, steal this land. That sounds legit. But I think
what does that mean?
There's this long again, there's a long history of this, right? This covenant relationship, mm-hmm. right? It goes back to 1630, right? John Winthrop, a model of Christian charity, this sermon where he talks about New England, the Massachusetts Bay Colony will become a city upon a hill. You know, we're a new Israel. We're the new chosen people. I tend to be a little more nuanced on this question of American exceptionalism, right? I think America is an exceptional experiment. There's no other country in the world that was born out of the Enlightenment in the way that America was. There's something unique and exceptional about the American experience. Where I part ways with this kind of Christian right American exceptionalism is that you baptize that, right?
Right. You sanctify it.
Yeah, sanctify it, right? You say, well, God has made us exceptional and we are new Israel. And that Massachusetts Bay 17th century John Winthrop idea, historians and literary critics and stuff have shown has pervaded our culture for the last 300 years, 400 years now, right? 1630, where we have come to believe ourselves as part of this special covenant, that we are unique, that we are exceptional in this kind of godly way. So I think the way in which, you know, you put it exactly right, Clint, God will bless us if we get the Supreme Court right, you know, and if we put Amy Coney Barrett there, this will be another example of, you know, Roe versus Wade will be overturned and God will bless us. I'm not quite sure what happens when the abortion rate does not go down, which is very possible after you overturn Roe versus Wade. I'm not really sure what happens when abortion rates go up in places like New York and California, as many people drive to New York and California to get abortions because they can't get one in their own state, right? I mean, you know, will God be displeased then? And if he is, then what happened to your political agenda, right? The Christian right, and again, you alluded to this, people think the Christian right is a religious movement or some kind of spiritual movement. It is a political movement formed by kind of very erroneous theological claims rooted in dominionism and these other things, right? I mean, the whole point of any political movement is to obtain power. And the Christian right wants power and they will do anything to get it. This is why they like to, you know, they like Trump to sort of sing their praises. They like to go to the White House and get a pat on the back. They want to make sure they get a seat at, even though it was a coronavirus spreader event, right?
Yeah, super spreader.
They need a seat at this Amy Coney Barrett announcement. They need to show their constituency how important they are. Yep. You know, there's a piece today by this Christian website, the Christian Post, former political editor, a guy named Nap Nasworth, who resigned because the website was going to become a pro-Trump website and endorse Trump in an editorial. But he has a piece today where he talks about the way that these Christian right leaders would actually unsolicited write letters to the Christian Post asking them to write articles about their appearance on Fox News and so forth. Like, look at me, I was on Fox News. You should write an article about this to show how important
promote
I am.
Me.
Yeah, and they all work. See, this, there's a piece of this that's not even theological, this kind of Christian right dominionism. There are powerful, like, PR firms and people with connections to power in the Trump White House who are working behind the scenes. There's a man named Johnny Moore, who is a PR guy, working behind the scenes to make sure that this Christian dominion idea of a Christian America, which Trump is, you know, advancing, is out there, right? Is getting press, right? Yeah. This is
getting
much more than just
out there.
Yeah, I mean, there are all kinds of things in the machine at work, cogs in the machine. There's a lot of money involved in promoting this. And that's what I mean. It's a political movement. It's not a theological movement or a biblical movement. The Christian right operates just like any other political lobbying group operates, right?
Absolutely. Well, we know, for example, like guys like Lance Wallnow, he's taught classes in Congress and in various departments of government on Seven Mountains mandate stuff. Yeah. You've got a guy like Ralph Drollinger, Capital Ministries. He's in those corridors of power. Tony Perkins, Family Research. I mean, the list is virtually endless, isn't it?
Well,
We'll come right back with the second half of my conversation with Dr. John Fia in just a few minutes. This is really interesting because I'm thinking that Dr. John Fia, he's the first evangelical that I've spoken to in a long, long time. And in fact, in the second half, we're going to get into some of his own beliefs as an evangelical, one of the very few prominent voices who's speaking out against what he calls the court evangelicals, those evangelical leaders that are prominently supportive of Donald Trump and have been going back as far as 2015, early 2016, early on in Trump's candidacy, and their resolve has only hardened, most of them, over the last 4 years. And so what's going to happen in this upcoming election, which as I'm doing this recording, it's just in a few days. This is the end of October as I'm doing this now. And so what's going to happen? What's going to happen to the evangelical church? And this is a question, this is a concern that Dr. John Fia has. And if you read a lot of his writings, this is what he talks about. He's concerned about the state of the church moving forward, something in my case where I've given up on that, but we have an interesting discussion about that again in a few minutes. But before we get back into the chat, I wanted to give you a quick heads up as to the next episode that's going to drop here on Mindshift Podcast. I've had a really fantastic conversation with returning guest Andrew Jasko, and we're talking about religious trauma syndrome, and we're talking about the subject of a recent article that he wrote on how God is a fascist and how that relates not only to evangelical theology, but also to the Trump support. And it's really kind of changed my focus in the last couple of months here when I came across that article by Andrew. And so we talked about this whole thing about religious trauma syndrome and how it relates. So if you're a person who's come out of religion, out of a cult, this episode I think you're going to find is very, very helpful. Andrew has a lot of really clear points on what is trauma, what is religious trauma, how can you heal from it, what are some of the resources available to you. If you've been listening to the show for a while, you know that I've talked about RTS with other experts in the field. I talked to Dr. Marlene Winnell last year. I've talked with Jana Selby from Canada, and also Laura Anderson, who's a therapist in the States. So this is something that I myself have been working through, coming out of my own background and a fundamentalist cult as a child, growing up in very, very fundamentalist evangelical religion, Christianity in my case, but this is something that's near and dear to my heart. So that conversation was helpful to me personally, so I think you're going to find that beneficial as well. Just wanted to say, too, that if you want to support the show on Patreon, that gives you access to some fantastic resources, one of which is the Mindshift Podcast Zoom calls that we do every month. And in fact, as I'm doing this recording, I'm looking forward to tomorrow, which would be the 25th of October. We're going to have Paul Kibble dropping in as our guest this month. We're going to be talking about his work on Christian hegemony. And then in the month of November, we actually have two Zoom calls scheduled. We've got Peter Montgomery on the 8th of November from the Right Wing Watch. And then on the 22nd of November, we have Sam Perry and Andrew Whitehead dropping in to talk about their book, Taking America Back for God. And I think I have booked Frank Schaefer to come in early December, maybe the first or second weekend of December before the holidays hit. So I'm super excited about getting to talk to Frank again and letting him interact with the really great people that are in the group on Facebook. So if that's something of interest to you, you can look at the show notes. The link to the Patreon page is in there. All right, let's get on back into the second half of this chat with Dr. John Fia as we start to explore his own basis in evangelicalism and why he, as a Christian, is speaking out in this era of Trump's court evangelicals and the history of the Christian right. Why does it matter, especially to him as an evangelical and as a historian? And I know you've done a lot of critiquing of, you call them these court evangelicals, but you yourself identify as an evangelical.
Yes.
So why are you speaking out against these court evangelicals?
Well, I think the court evangelicals are driven by, and again, you name some of these names, I would add to the list, you know, people like Paul White, who claims Franklin Graham, spiritual advisor, Robert Jeffress, the pastor of the First Baptist Church, who there's a joke. I learned today there's a joke within, before we came on, I learned today there's a joke within Southern Baptist circles that the most dangerous place in Southern Baptist life is between Robert Jeffress and a television camera. You know, I mean, these guys are really
desperate to be on camera.
Yeah, they're desperate to sort of have their celebrities and so forth. But, you know, so what's the deal with these people? You know, I would argue as an evangelical Christian myself, who believes in the authority of the scriptures, the Bible, in my life, try to live a life in accordance with the teachings of the Bible. You know, I believe that Jesus death on the cross, you know, redeemed the world from sin. You know, I believe in a conversion, right? One needs to embrace and accept the teachings of the gospel in a very deep and serious way. That's not just kind of cultural. You know, I believe in
nothing controversial. In other words, an evangelical point of view.
I believe in sharing my faith and being active and living out my faith in the world. Right. So I'm an evangelical, but my evangelical faith also teaches me that the pursuit of power goes against the pursuit of worldly power or political power, kind of contradicts everything about the core tenets of my faith. You know, we worship a savior, you know, who gave up power, who sacrificed on a cross. You know, I always think about Jesus in Matthew chapter 4, when he's being tempted by the devil. And the devil says to him, you know, I will give you all the kingdoms and the power of this world if you will just bow down to me. You know, and Jesus, of course, said, right, well, let me think about that. You know, if you can get me like 3 Supreme Court justices, I might take your offer.
Yeah.
You know, no.
We got a deal.
And you know what's also fascinating? I was just rereading that passage recently. And after Jesus rejects this offer of political power, that was the last of, I think, the 3 temptations that Satan brought to him there in Matthew chapter 4. And then the devil leaves and Jesus is left there. And I always skipped over this part of the verse. It then says, the angels came and ministered to him.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, God came and ministered to Jesus, like he, you know, offered him comfort. And, you know, so in other words, here's Jesus, right? He just rejected worldly power. And what happens? God, you know, as speaking here as an evangelical, right? You know, God comes and says, you did the right thing. I'm here to comfort you. I'm here to love you. You did not embrace power. You embraced humility, right? You know,
passed,
I mean,
the test in a way.
It wasn't like, oh my gosh, how did you, you know, why did you turn that down? We could have gotten the presidency too. You know, come on, this is how but God was saying, but God was saying, no, we're gonna change the world. We're gonna change the world in a different kind of way here. Right. You know,
more grassroots, isn't it?
Yeah, more grassroots, but also more kind of, we're going to invert things, right? You know, we're going to advance our political entity, right? The kingdom of God, as we evangelicals like to say, in a very different way than the world is going to try to. So I think that's one piece of this whole court evangelical phenomenon. I think a lot of them also play upon fear. You know, the fear of ordinary evangelicals. You know, how many times will you hear one of these evangelical preachers, you know, say things like, you know, unless we can get Amy Coney Barrett or Neil Gorsuch, or, you know, especially after Scalia died, it was right in the middle of the 2016 primary, you know, and you had these court evangelicals, including politicians too, like Ted Cruz and others. And Trump bought into this. Trump learned this quickly too, you know. America's falling off a cliff. If we don't, or democracy will fall off a cliff unless you elect Trump, who will appoint, you know, it turned out to be Neil Gorsuch, right, was the first. But this playing to fear that, like, all, like, Joe Biden's a socialist, right? You know, like, people from a certain, actually, I don't have a problem with socialism, you know, as a Christian. That's a whole other discussion, right? I mean, you know, can socialism be Christian? But the fear is, right, you know, of evangelicals of a certain age, when you start talking about socialism, you know, I mean, the average Trump voter was 57 years old, right? So you start talking about socialism, Stalin and Brezhnev and
where do they go?
And the communist, you know,
Soviet Union.
Yeah, all that comes into people's minds. This is playing upon people's fear. Now, you know, I'll be the first one to tell you, as an American historian, that all politics is based upon fear, right? You want to, you know, but for Christians to be involved in this, to me, you know, we have all of these admonitions to fear not. Perfect love casts out fear, right? You know, I often use the quote by the Pulitzer Prize winning novelist, Marilynne Robinson, who is also a Christian. She has a wonderful piece on fear in the New York Times. This was back in 2015, maybe, in which she says, you know, fear is not a Christian habit of mind. But yet the Christian right, in order to claim their Christian nation and scare people that their Christian nation is, their white Christian nation is in jeopardy, appeal to fear constantly and have built an entire political philosophy around scaring people into believing that their golden age that they once experienced where everything was Christian is falling apart. You know, this gets into the nostalgia piece of this.
Yep. Right? This longing, make America great again.
Yeah, this longing for a world that probably never existed in the first place. And if it did exist, which I doubt it did, it's not coming back, right? You know, we're not going to become a white Protestant nation again. Right.
And it wasn't so good for a lot of other people too. You know, that's the thing. I read an article the other day where they were talking about Donald Trump's 4th of July speech on Mount Rushmore.
Yeah.
And he talked about, you know, our ancestors came across the oceans from Europe and they settled this land and then they moved westward in their wagons and they established towns and brought civilization with them and on and on. And this author was saying, wait a minute, what about enslaved people? That didn't make it into this speech. What about the Native Americans whose land we stole? You know, those didn't factor into this speech. It's a complete, like you say, American exceptionalism, manifest destiny type of speech from a white European point of view. I guess that's what they're trying to get back to, to make America great again.
Well, that's, I've said this numerous times. I'll say it again, you know, this idea of this slogan of make America great again. You know, I'm an American historian, right? So, you know, I find that a lot of people, when they hear that phrase, make America great again, a lot of people I talk to will focus, will zero in on the word great. Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, great. When were we great? You know, I'm a historian, so I focus in on the word again.
Mm.
Right. In other words, you tell me when America was great. When was it? Like the 50s? I'm asking this rhetorically, right? The 50s, the Reagan era, the 19th century, the time of the founding, right? When was America? What do you want to get back to when America was great? Right.
Right. What period is the best?
Yeah, and then I'll, as a historian, will be happy to kind of step into that conversation and say, let's look at what life was like for everybody during that period, right? I think nostalgia is an inherently selfish way of looking at the past because you get nostalgic for things that are only related to you and your story, right? So, you know, mostly it's white people who are nostalgic. I mean, there's a racial component to nostalgia.
That's right.
It's white middle-class people who say like, you know, oh, I wish I could get back to the good old days of Ozzy and Harriet or Leave It to Beaver or whatever. No,
Father
African.
Knows best.
Yeah. African Americans, they may be nostalgic for some kind of, you know, they miss their family or some kind of, you know, but publicly they're not nostalgic. No African-American one, as much as we have race problems today, which need to be addressed. I think most African-Americans would tell you, no one wants to go back, right? No one wants to
go back to slavery.
No one, you know, or
civil rights,
Jim Crow or segregation, right? So I think this nostalgia is something that is very much tied into the Christian nation, right? A white Christian America used to be a white Protestant America. And then finally by like the 1970s or 60s or 70s, finally after JFK, right, you finally are allowing Catholics to come into it now. So it's a, it's a kind of white Christian America. And the future of America is not white and it is, may not even be Christian, you know? So this creates to try to understand the Trump voter, this creates a lot of anxiety and fear and concern, right? Everything is changing. And when things are changing in this way, you start tapping into ideologies to kind of reclaim what's being lost, even though it's not reclaimable anymore. And you also turn to political strongmen who will promise to bring everything back. And I think white evangelicals are particularly to blame for all of this, simply because everything about their faith tells them that this is not right. This kind of fear mongering. So you have like white evangelicals who will find their highest allegiance to their Christian nation, the United States, Christian nation as they define it, right? To the United States, as opposed to having their highest allegiance to, say, a immigrant from Central America who is a deeply Christian person and will one day, as evangelicals would say, one day see you in heaven. They'll see each other in heaven. They share the same faith. They're brothers and sisters in Christ, as evangelicals like to put it. But yet, they must be turned away, and their alliance is more to their nation than to their fellow members of the kingdom of God. That's a problem, right? And I think this is where this Rushdunian Christian nationalism that, you know, you're an expert on kind of comes in here, right? And it divides Christians because nationalism becomes the thing that's, and nationalism is often tied to, in this case, kind of racial differences too, or ethnic differences.
Absolutely. In fact, you just articulated almost word for word what Frank Schaeffer said at the end of our podcast the other day. He said exactly that. Of all the people that Americans should be welcoming, American Christians, it's the people from Mexico and South America, because most of them are either Catholic or Pentecostals. And so he says, you know, the guy that far right militia shot at the river swimming across into Texas or wherever was probably a pastor of a church from South America. He should be welcoming these people. And in fact, if they want numbers for their evangelical churches, the Latino population is one of the fastest growing evangelical populations in America. So why are we turning them away? It's got to have something to do with race and the fact that they happen to be brown people, people of color. So it gives the lie to that whole thing, doesn't it?
I think you're exactly right. You know, and I think that's from a perspective of what Trumpism is doing to the church. I think this is the biggest issue, right? We are seeing the kind of dark side of evangelicalism in America, because the evangelicalism has been so held captive by the GOP and by Christian nationalism and by this Reconstructionism that you're talking about, right? The movement as a religion, the churches have been so held captive by this that they can no longer distinguish between brothers and sisters in the kingdom. They'd rather make peace with an atheist who believes we should overturn abortion than with a fellow Christian. They would be willing perhaps to make peace with some kind of militia group who wants to kill the governor of Michigan than they would with Christian immigrants, you know, trying to get into the country. That's probably a little extreme right there, but it illustrates the principle.
It's essentially what's happened. And I think it's fascinating to me to read your work, because as you say, as an evangelical, I think you've still got this project to save something of what you think Christianity or evangelicalism, whatever it is, should be salvaged. So I think that's absolutely fascinating. I mean, I happen to think, well, I walked away from the whole thing. Basically, the Trump evangelical vote was the last straw for me. I was already deconstructing and having a lot of issues. But when I saw that, and now over the last 4 years, I'm like, no, I'm not doing it anymore.
And so, I don't blame you. You know, I don't know you, Clint. We just met today, right? But, you know, I would want to encourage you to, I hope that you're still clinging to some kind of faith, right? But that, let's not get into that. But I don't blame people for leaving evangelicalism, you know, and I'm not sure, I'll be honest with you, I'm not sure how much longer I can continue to claim that label. I cling to it because at its core, evangelical means the good news of the gospel. And at this point, I'm still saying to myself, like, you know, and it could be a losing battle, and it may be. As a matter of fact, the closer we get to the election, so forth, the more I realize it could be a losing battle. But there's still something within me, the evangelical movement, as a 16-year-old kid who converted to it and had his life changed, my life, you know, we talk about the anti-intellectualism of evangelicalism. For me, as a kind of working class kid, first generation college student it was the evangelicals that like taught me how to read and how to engage mm-hmm. with the text and how to think and how to right yeah. I know a lot of people can't say that, right? But for me, the evangelical movement took me in a direction where I was ultimately able to critique it. But if I hadn't become mm-hmm. an evangelical, you know, so I still, there's a lot of autobiography, a lot of biography and all of that too. And so, you know, everybody's different and everybody's unique, but I'm still willing, at least for the moment, to kind of fight for that label and not allow people like the court evangelicals or the Trumpists to sort of reclaim it. But again, I'm not sure how much longer I can do that. If you know, if you see like in a month, I'm like writing a post somewhere about saying I'm done, you know, don't be
surprised. I've had enough.
Don't be surprised. Yeah, we'll see what happens in November. I'm hoping that, you know, if the numbers are up around 81% again, I'm not sure what, you know, how I'll respond yet.
I know. I hear you. Well, I know you have another appointment in a few minutes, and you said you wanted to go get yourself a cup of coffee before the next chat, so I won't keep you too long, but I would love to chat with you again if you have time, maybe down the road after the election or next year if you have a little bit of time. There's a lot of stuff I wanted to get into with you, but we are running out of time, and you've got to go get a drink before your next chat. So
right, my next meeting is with one of my students. So, hey, I appreciate it. I'd love to come back anytime.
Absolutely. Just a quick one then. How can people get a hold of you? What's the best place to find your work?
Sure. I blog at a blog called The Way of Improvement Leads Home. That's www.thewayofimprovement.com. But the easiest way is just to Google my name and it'll be the first or second hit. I blog every single day, multiple posts a day. I'm committed to that venue, mostly things at the intersection of American history, religion, politics. So we get about, you know, 10,000-12,000 readers a day. So join our community. Yeah, on Facebook too, I have an author's page, and at Twitter, it's @JohnFia1.
All right. Thank you so much. And I will talk to you again.
Okay.